Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jane McKinley. Jane McKinley is a professional oboist and artistic director of the Dryden Ensemble, a Baroque chamber music group based in Princeton, New Jersey. Her poems have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Southern Poetry Review, and on Poetry Daily. Her sonnet, Mud Season, won the 2008 Patricia Dobler Poetry Award from Carlow University. She lives in Hopewell, New Jersey, and her new book, entitled Vanitas, was published by Texas Tech University Press in 2011. Hi, Jane, how are you?
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, really happy that you came from New Jersey to be here.
Right, I've been in Pittsburgh quite a few times, so it's nice to come back.
Yeah, nice to have you. So you're going to read some poems from your new book.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm going to start with a poem called Speaking Gillikin, and it's based on memories of when I was 3 years old. And Gillikin is actually was my sort of private language. Some children have imaginary friends. I had my own language. Speaking Gillikin. It was a perfect language, rarefied, precise, and all my own. At three, I spoke it fluently to dust motes in prismatic light and to the bear who sang Brahms each night as headlights prowled across my bedroom walls. Gillikin gave voice to the night my father scooped me out of bed to see the northern lights, to the witch who lived in Granny's cellar, who hid in ripples of sea-green glass. It could evoke the ethereal spirit of the stray cat we took in, moth gray, fur in clumps, three legs, half a tail. If Gillikin had words for loss or death, I don't remember what they were. I lost a red boot, stuck in the mud when I fled from a giant bumblebee, but it happened in a dream. Animals died, old ewes, frumpy in their tattered coats after shearing. There was a word for orphans, lambs who nuzzled our knees after we fed them, and an expression for the black-eyed guppies whose mother ate them up. I made up a lovely name for the tortoises from Galapagos, the ones I sat on at the reptile gardens. I saw them again last summer. All of them were still alive, thriving on melons and prickly pears, eaten in slow motion. The next poem I'll read is a sonnet called Mud Season, which was the winner of the 2008 Patricia Dobler Award, and one reason I now have a connection with Pittsburgh. In this poem, the Philip is my three-year-old brother, and he still remembers this event. Mud Season, second grade. Mid-April, bloodroots promise in the air. We ride along with Dad to see the piglets born the night before. The pickup swerves, jiggles to a halt. Dad's face goes gray. His dark hair is damp with sweat. He stumbles out, collapsing near the ditch. Run for help. Leave Philip here. I fly, my winged keds barely grazing, smeared with mud, reach a distant farmhouse, rapping sharp as knuckles can. Scared no one will come. The tar patch door creaks open, and a child peeks out. It's Debbie Tucky. She's the one we laughed at last week, taunting her with combs. Her mother holds my shoulder while her wild-haired, gentle father rushes to the phone. I should perhaps say that I grew up in Iowa, and I grew up in a place about 2 hours south of Lake Wobegon, of Garrison Keillor. The next poem is also a childhood poem called The Balloon, and the bill in it is my brother, who was then around 11, I think. The balloon. It arrives midweek, wrapped in brown paper, but my brother Bill waits until Saturday, till the coast is clear, mother out all afternoon to shop for dresses with Marcia and Anne. He retrieves the package from under his bed, an official Weather Service balloon. Tearing it open, he unfolds the pleated latex, spreads it out all 16 feet across the living room floor, fetches the vacuum cleaner to inflate it, reattaching the hose to the exhaust the way he sometimes did when it was his turn to dry the silverware. The balloon takes shape like a white whale out of water, stranded on the beige carpet, expanding past oak columns into the hallway. We hear small popping sounds as air loosens pleats, smooths them to round, stretching milky latex to fill the entire room. By now, we're shrieking at the sight of it. The little ones are jumping up and down, and it's about to touch the brass chandelier when a car pulls up out front, and we see Marcia pointing to the window, her mouth wide open, the three of them staring toward us, so that Bill forgets to turn the vacuum off. The chandelier's brass point starts poking in, and the whale explodes in a great white blast of talcum powder. A post-blizzard silence sets in, all surfaces white, from the dining room to the second landing of the staircase. That's all I remember, not the front door opening or our mother shouting, "What on earth?" as if the blast had knocked me senseless. It's Bill who can remember Marcia pointing from the car. And where was Dad out checking on the newborn lambs? Until a few years ago, I had no idea why Bill wanted a weather balloon to begin with. He and his pal Howie had planned to tether it just out of town and asked Dave Christensen for help. Dave, the local science whiz, would make a laser, skip college, go straight to Bell Labs. They wanted Dave to rig it up with blinking lights and eerie sounds so people would believe it had come from outer space. Now it all seems alien, as if time had launched our memories into orbit, leaving us under that chandelier, unable to remember what comes next.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jane McKinley. She's reading from her new book, Vanitas, and I want to say, first of all, congratulations on your new book.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's yeah, you can't see it out there, obviously, but it's a beautiful cover and a terrific book. I want to ask you, Jane, about I guess, kind of the obvious question about the relationship between music and writing. You're a very accomplished musician, and we know from you talking about your private language as a child, which you just owned, that you have a great connection and attachment to language. Also, is there a relationship between music and language in the composition process of your poems? Do you think?
Oh, definitely. I think a lot of times a poem starts as like a feeling inside, and often it's finding the rhythm of the opening line that gets me into the poem, or finding the sounds of the words I want to use. But rhythm is very important to me. So
do you actually hear like a line of music, as in oboe, or do you
not necessarily, more just a rhythm, uh-huh. A speech rhythm or a musical rhythm?
Because I know. Sometimes when I go out and listen to music, I get ideas for poems. Does that happen to you at all?
Does, actually. I wrote a poem last spring that I'd been thinking about writing for a long time, and it was based on a Bach aria that I'd performed on oboe. And it's essentially an annunciation aria, but it always seemed to me like the music didn't really fit the annunciation theme. So I wrote a poem about that, trying to come to terms with that.
Yeah, that seems great. I mean, it seems endless in a way, with all the music that you are familiar with and know so much better than most people.
Yeah, I think I'll probably write, I think I still have quite a few Bach poems in me, so.
Okay. Also, I mean, there's this wonderful sense of there's a sure voice in your poems and a steadiness that sometimes seems like a balance for some of the sorrow or the poignancy in your work. Is that something that you're trying to set up, or is that something that...
I think it just comes to me. I mean, when I started writing poetry in the spring, I mean, I wrote as a child and as an adolescent, and I started writing again in 2003. And it was really words coming to me, words and rhythms coming to me. And I think the voice is the voice that had been in my head for a long time, but had never really come out.
Mm-hmm. And how did you know it was back? How did you know it was time to come out?
It was sort of a strange thing that happened. I was taking a nonprofit management class to run my chamber music ensemble. And one of our assignments was about time management, but we had to write our own obituaries. And I ended up writing, you know, that in addition to performing music, I was a writer. And I'd never really thought about it. I mean, I always enjoyed writing when I was younger, but... And then I became sort of obsessed with it and thinking, you know, if you're really going to write, you should do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it took another year and a half before it really happened.
Wow.
But then once I started writing, I couldn't stop.
Wow. That's really interesting. I've never heard anyone say it like that. I mean, I definitely work with women who haven't written for a while and then say what you've said. You know, I used to write when I was little, when I was growing up. And then it comes back, and it's such a great thing when it comes back, and then you start.
And it was so exciting to have this whole new world of people and to meet poets, and I felt at home in that world in a way I'd never felt before.
Oh, great. Okay, could you read some more?
Starlings. Through the windshield, I watch jittering clouds of starlings strobing light and sky into pieces too small to comprehend. Is this what my sister saw? Final moments scissored into nanoseconds, kaleidoscopic terror. Then, triptych of seventh grade art. 1. Wax figure. I learned to model beeswax, warming bits between my fingers, feeling what I couldn't see, ears and eyebrows, nose and lips, applying pressure to the parts until the clump became a whole, a bearded sage with weathered face, old man my father would never become. 2, perspective. Our teacher taught us how to draw in more than two dimensions, how to connect each surface to the point where everything becomes so small it slips into infinity. At last, I'd found a kind of drawing I could master with sharp pencil and a straight edge. I set to work designing my dream room, boxy cocoon in blue and orange, a room I wouldn't have to share, where I could lie and stare at cracks for hours behind a door that locked. The teacher meant to call on me, but named my sister 3 months dead. I couldn't speak. Everything went flat. Looking down, I watched my pencil slash straight lines, a highway fenced in with barbed wire, telephone poles, then slipped into another dimension as lines struck the vanishing point. 3. Light. We saw a painting by Vermeer, saw the light the milkmaid felt upon her cheek, watched it turn crusty bread and creamy milk to radiance, an ordinary breakfast transformed. I hurried home that afternoon, rushed up the stairs to perch above the second landing, swathed in color from leaded glass, and closed my eyes, still looking through shut lids toward light, to warmth transfused from other worlds, unearthly reds awash with gold. The next poem I'm going to read is a poem about Johann Sebastian Bach, and it's about a moment in his life that always haunted me, It's a moment that was described in his obituary that was written by his son, Carl Philip Emanuel. Variations on a psalm tune, with the epigraph from Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. As Bach crosses the threshold, he's struck by absence, a quiet so profound, all he hears is the echo of that stillness in his ears, the absence of feet on the oak staircase, of laughter, music, the smell of barley soup. He drops his portmanteau of manuscripts in the hallway, shakes out his dusty cloak, and calls out to Maria Barbara. No answer. He enters the music room, but stops when he sees violins hanging on the wall. After weeks in Karlsbad, entertaining Leopold and pallid hangers-on, who took the waters hoping for a cure, Bach had imagined children rushing to greet him, Friedemann impatient to show off his latest Allemande, and dear Maria Barbara gently shushing, insisting he must have his dinner first. Tired, he sits at the clavier, lets his fingers lead the way, smoothing out the spirals of distracted thought. Before he senses what is wrong, he's halfway through the psalm that kept repeating in his head, making him forget the lurching coach. Now all he sees is melody with counterpoint, as he struggles to recapture passing chords, forgotten graces. Fingers draw him on the way that rivers flow past cities, towns, through ancient Babylon, where harps hung silent on the willows. He cannot stop his hands from singing, stop the flow that sweeps him on, transports him to a land so strange he hears nothing but music. A voice breaks in. Words disrupt the rush of psalm like boulders falling from the sky. Maria Barbara, his right hand falters. Tote, his mouth so dry, his tongue cleaves to the roof. Begraben, little ones shattered as if dashed against the rocks.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jane McKinley. And she's reading from her new book entitled Vanitas. Well, that's such a nice poem that you just read, and I was finding myself just being lulled into a really nice state of listening and forgetting that I'm doing the show, which is always a good sign. It's like, oh, this is so beautiful. I want to ask you about the challenge of writing. There is in your book, there is the childhood death of the sister, which you've read some of those poems, and I want to ask you about the challenge of writing those poems and how to go about doing that, because there's plenty of writers out there who have had, you know, tragedies, mm-hmm. and really tough emotional things to write about, and they get blocked or they don't know how to go. So I wonder if you could talk about that process a little, how it was for you.
Wait 30 years, and then it comes out. It really just sort of happened. And the poem Triptych from Seventh Grade Art, I started seventh grade just after my sister died, and that moment of being called by your sister's name, but she's dead. I mean, I'd been called by my other sister's name many times, but, you know, then once your sister's dead and someone makes a mistake and calls you by her name, it just seemed like it needed to become a poem. And I never was very good at in the visual arts. In fact, I used to say I could draw like a third grader until my daughter was in third grade, and then I was demoted. but I had a really wonderful art teacher in seventh grade, and we did all kinds of things. And I found I could succeed in ways that I hadn't been able to succeed before. So I was really fond of this teacher, but at the same time, she slipped and, you know, called me by my sister's name. So I don't know. I think in that poem, though, I tried to really stay in the child's mind and not look at it from this side. Mm-hmm. And I think at least the first section of my book are really told from, for the most part, from the child's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it also seems like you're saying that you found one very particular detail that, says a lot, you know.
Right. And you know, for her, it was just a slip of the tongue.
Right.
You know, it was nothing, but just in that situation, it became a huge thing to me.
Right, of course. And it has a lot of power in the poem. And it sounds like, and from some of your answers, you're saying the voices just came. It just came. And which I totally believe you. But it sounds right. Like there's this just organic thing that's happening with you as an artist, in that when it's time, the poems come. When it's time, the voices come.
Right. I mean, I still work really hard at them, especially, I mean, some poems come out pretty effortlessly, but then others I work at very difficult. I mean, for example, the variations on a psalm tune, I had, say, 2/3 to 3/4 of it finished, and then I had an ending, but it didn't, I knew it wasn't quite the right ending. And it took a while for that right ending to come, or to find where to go. Initially, I had all the... At that point, Bach had 5 children, and I had them coming into the room as he's playing, and it became a little too melodramatic.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like your poems are so have such a clear, present voice, and don't go into sentimentality, and don't go into the melodrama at all, and. Does that happen with revision? Are you saying sometimes that...
No, I think most of that is there from the beginning.
Okay.
Actually, I'm in some ways a fairly sentimental person, but not in poetry.
Interesting. Okay. And you're a full-time musician. Is that correct?
Right. Less full-time now since the economy went down a lot. But... it's actually a nice balance doing poetry, and then when I'm really busy, I do mostly music, and then mm-hmm. I sort of switch back and forth.
That's great.
And okay. I run a chamber music group, which always takes a lot of time, and I have to ask people for money. I told
so
someone
you're a fundraiser too.
In my next life, I'm not going to have to ask people for money.
Yeah, that sounds good, doesn't it? Could you read some more poems?
Yes, thanks. Moss. I have a weakness for moss. For things that grow on the dark side, the northern outposts of trees and rocks, for anything that can swallow enough light to make green velvet, or that springy feel of dancing on your parents' bed when they have told you no. The afternoon I climbed down Flying Mountain, I wanted to name each moss I found, not with Latin appellations scribbled down by botanists who peer one-eyed through dusty microscopes, but names to suit the characters of mosses I met with naked eyes. The not-so-common names that mushrooms have, like weeping widow, collared earth star, flimsy veil, or dead man's fingers. I dreamed up names like silver tuffet, chevron green bristle, beetle chalice, clinging troll's hair. Why bother with microscopes if no one answers when you call? The moss doesn't care. It keeps on growing, concealing shadows it feels but cannot see, those cold places no one talks about, places without names. If you knew what to call them, they wouldn't be there. Learning Italian. This is a poem I wrote after my first visit to Italy, and before I went there, I'd had 8 Italian lessons, and so that's reflected in the poem. Learning Italian. In Italy, we live in the present. We haven't learned to conjugate the past, those years spent wishing we were here instead of there. And so we live, we love, we eat without a backward glance. We have no words for what is gone. Sarcophagi hold someone else's dead. It's possible to live forever here. The ancients do. They speak to us of rage, ambition, passion, grief, shades of marble deaf to time. See how that olive tree conceals its age. Feathered gray obscures gnarled limbs, clings even when the winter comes, sheltering the blue-black fruit. The next poem is called At Bubble Pond, and like the moss poem, it's really set in Acadia National Park, which has been one of my family's favorite places. We started going there when my son was two, and we've been back at least every other year since. And he's now much older. At Bubble Pond, late afternoon light angles off the surface of the pond, remaking mountains and sky in its own image. I move to another boulder, raising an arm to keep my balance. A wave erupts, a flat cascade, as if my palm were skull, pulling water out of itself into a white flash without getting wet. My eyes drop down to find out what my gesture stirred up underneath. The water unwrinkles, its deadpan look dissolves to sheen, so at last I can see the streams of minnows sorting themselves beneath the surface, returning to the starting position, their bodies parallel, heads pointing toward the deep. With broad strokes, I ruffle the water, repainting that rush of muscle and nerve, pausing between movements the way a conductor waits for the air to clear, for sound to drift to nothingness.
We have time for one more.
Okay. This poem is called Persephone Descending. As if she were cockeyed, one eye trained on what's below, the other squinting toward the sky, the landscape divides. What's at her feet is variegated, tinged with ash, goldenrod smothered by silver, Queen Anne's lace laid waste by frost, curled into a bird's nest, flecked with shroud. The eye still angling life reels in a blaze of pomegranate, quince, a copper beech, blue plums, and sun-streaked wheat. She's caught between two worlds, an eye in each, the way I am this morning, winter pawing at my feet, while autumn rages through the trees, dying to fall.
The poetry of Jane McKinley, reading from her book, Vanitas. Thank you so much for being here. It was so good.
Well, it was a delight to be here. Thanks again.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.